Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will be finding common ground and taking it to the next level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. This show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. It's my hope that you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. This is a no-holds-barred show. My guests will have differing spiritual belief systems, and some will have no spiritual beliefs. You may or you may not agree with things that are said. What I'd ask you to do is keep an open mind. This way, you can see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now, tonight, my guest is Paula Ginnon. And Paula has worked in the entertainment industry for over 25 years, 20 and a half of that for Warner Brothers Studios. 2009 was a life-changing experience for Paula. After working in the corporate world, she decided to use her professional and life experience to become an entrepreneur. Grateful for her training and experience in the corporate world, Paula wanted to do more for the community in the second half of her life. Like so many baby boomers, Paula found herself behind the times in the digital internet technology world, as well as the economic change in the United States, and had to reinvent herself by finding her voice with producing and hosting her own show and other internet shows and podcasts. She says that her mission is to be the catalyst of information and resources for career transitioning baby boomers to turn their passions into success, both personally and financially, by utilizing the World Wide Web to launch their message to the masses. With her 20 years extended experience in public speaking, customer service, and in the media industry, and 30 years in the corporate world, she brings you an innovative media platform to educate, inspire, and connect people who want to make a difference in the world. And so I'd like to welcome Paula Ginnon. Hi, Paula. How are you?
Hi, David. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, thanks. Yeah. it's a nice, balmy 39 degrees here in Syracuse,
oh.
So it's a heat wave.
So you guys had a pretty brutal winter, so is it yielding a little bit and heading towards spring? I think spring is supposed to start in a couple weeks.
Hopefully. It has been brutal. It's been cold. We've just are a little bit ahead of our average seasonal snowfall, so I consider that it's been a mild winter snow-wise, but cold-wise, we've had a lot of record colds, so... Yeah, a little bit different from what weather you've been having out your way.
It's been strange, too. We did get some rain, which we needed badly, but we need a lot more.
Well, I hope you get it. Droughts are no fun.
Yeah. No, they're not. Yeah. No, they're not.
Well, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about your life journey. And to begin with... if you could talk about what your life journey was like being an Air Force brat and coming to find some stability in your life.
Yeah, I always say my first 10 years of my life was in the Air Force, because when you're a father or any parent that's in the military, the family is. It's part of the culture. It's part of what was going on. And at the time, being a baby boomer, it's the height of the Cold War. So my dad was in World War II in the Army Air Force, got out, and due to helping his parents. He was an only child. He could go back in as a sergeant, full pay, go overseas, and it was a lot of it was to help my grandparents because they were living, they were pretty tight. It was tough for them. So he decided to do that, and then it made a career. In that, I mean, it was a lot of fun being in the military, but as far as going to different places, I lived in England for 3 years. So you do have a bit of an eclectic experience as a child versus many people after my dad retired who stayed in one place and all went to kindergarten. But you have a bohemian's existence. My brother always said we were like migrant farm workers, which you were. So that with a combination of being an introvert, it was hard to connect because the minute that you come in to a situation, you may have to leave. My brother gave me a book to read called Military Brass. It was written by a woman who was a daughter of an Army colonel. And she said the two things military brats hate is hello and goodbye. Because you're going to say hello and you're going to say goodbye. So what happened in your early years, you develop who you are, is you don't learn to connect. You learn to be very self-reliant, not self-reliant, but on your own. You don't expect. You still don't know how to connect to people. That's what I found out. Even after my dad retired, it was still difficult. I would get a group of friends and they would leave and I expected it. I really don't know. I didn't know how to react to having a steady flow of friends. A lot of the people I met, and I was in fourth grade when my dad retired, they all knew each other since kindergarten. So I still felt like an outsider.
Mm.
And I remember, this is why I got, why movies and TV became kind of a friend. It was a way to escape. There is a scene from MASH. You remember the TV series MASH?
I sure do.
Margaret Houlihan. Yeah, Margaret Houlihan, the character played by Loretta Swit, was a daughter of an Army general. And there was a great episode, and they actually just showed it on MeTV a couple of weeks ago, that it was her birthday. She wanted something so special, but something happened and their Jeep broke down and she was with Klinger and he found out it was her birthday and he said, why didn't you say something? And this whole scene apparently was written by someone who understood Army brat. She was explaining, I went through 5 high schools, you know, practically, that she said, I never learned to connect. You couldn't rely on it. And I thought, yeah, that's about right. So it still stayed with you. It's kind of funny. My brother and I talk about that. As hard as we tried, it still was kind of still hard to connect and couldn't find that group of friends I'd find, and then they would leave. So I said, okay, they're just going to leave. You know, so that is a lot of brats talk about that, our military, whether you're Air Force, Army, Marine Corps, Navy, doesn't make any difference. There is that state of mind or behavior that you kind of go alone because you're afraid to say goodbye.
Well, how did that affect you as an adult in terms of connecting?
It was hard. I had an introvert personality, so I have a double whammy. I felt very alone at times. I remember walking a lot and I was by myself and I accepted it, but it hurt. You know, I tried to connect, but everybody seemed to leave. So I didn't know how to overcome it, I guess. You know, a lot of people still came in and out of my life. And maybe on a subconscious level, I set it up for that way, too.
Mm.
You know, that I didn't really work at it. You know, how, you know, relationships, you got to work.
Yes,
like anything
they do
else.
Take a lot of work.
Yes. You know, you take a lot of work and you write. And I found, I wasn't very good at letter writing. I look back and connecting with people. I should have written mm-hmm. more. I said, well, they're going to leave. I think on a subconscious, well, they're going to leave, and I'm going to have to leave. So I think on a subconscious level, that's what I did. It's not blaming anybody. It's trying to figure out. I realized I did not, or was not a good letter writer at all.
Now, you talked about fourth grade. Your father retired when you were in fourth grade. Is that when you began to settle down?
Yeah, that was supposed to. My dad retired because he wanted to have more stability. My brother was 3.5 years older than I was, and of course, it was starting the height of the Vietnam War, and he didn't really want to go ship out to Vietnam. And he felt it was time to give his two kids a little more stability. Now, mm-hmm. my added problem is, at the time, it was never coined, but I had to go back a year when I was in third grade to the second grade. So technically, I should have been in fifth grade. So I added to my insecurities and my shyness that I had a school problem, which in those days, in the mid-60s, learning disability wasn't even coined. You just had mm-hmm. a problem. And it was never solved because my parents relied on the professionals like teachers and counselors. Paula's having some problems, not reading or writing. It was math. And they just said, well, she's not really ready. Well, that didn't help anything. You know,
yeah,
and I
right.
literally, David, I really, I remember, my mother says, you still remember this. I said, oh, God, yes, because the kid's not stupid. I was sitting in my third grade class in the back of the room, and there was either a teacher or a counselor comes to the door, calls to me, takes me by the hand, and I walk down to the second grade. And if you ask me what my feeling is, failure.
Mm-hmm.
Humiliation.
Well, that must have been awful.
So, yeah. And that still, I think that's been something to really overcome even to this day. That little girl who had to walk down still is there to overcome that it doesn't become a block, a cement that drags with me. Because every mm-hmm. time I think I'm making mistakes, I'm going to walk down the second grade. I think that also led for me not taking chances. Because then I would fail.
Mm-hmm.
So if I just not do anything, I'll be okay. I didn't deal with the emotional impact. I wish I should have gone into counseling to deal with the emotional impact of that failure as a young age. Because it felt like that. And it was humiliating to walk into the second grade knowing that I was a year older than everyone else.
Mm. How did you overcome your learning disability?
I didn't really know I had one.
Mm-hmm.
It was math. I noticed I had some problems. I loved science and math, David. I wanted to be a zoology major when I was in high school. I wanted mm-hmm. to study animals and preserve them. I was in San Diego, and the San Diego Zoo was even in the 70s, was very active in conservation and endangered species. They educated, and I really wanted to, I felt I did better with animals than I did with humans. But I love science.
You're not alone.
I love studying science, but the math, I had problems. That was my biggest disability. I would be okay. And then when I get to the higher one, I couldn't see it, you know. And a classmate of mine in the problems were starting up again in fourth grade. And a classmate's mother said to my mother, Ginny, that was my mother, her name is Virginia, why don't you get Paula a tutor? So my mother found a tutor, and it helped a lot. But I think with me, the emotional part was affecting, and it was up and down with me. And I also, I think because of it, I would daydream a lot. I kind of escape a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I was listening to another, I produce other shows, including yours. I was listening to a woman, and I can't remember whether she was a channeler or a coach, saying that a lot of the daydreaming of people is there was a trauma that they had, and this is how they deal, why they don't focus or something.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, that's a thing. So my daydreams was an escape of the feeling of failing. I didn't, because I couldn't understand, I felt stupid, because the problems didn't go away. I mean, reading and writing was okay, but the math, but, and I think it all came together, and then also there were times that I had like a delayed reaction in learning. It's like I didn't get it until a little bit later, so everything kind of is competitive. So I felt, I felt very insecure and I felt stupid. You know, there
was
some
that's
I didn't
an awful
like.
Feeling.
I didn't like. Yeah, it was. I didn't really like who I was. I said, "Why? I wish I was smarter." So I really didn't. It's like having an illness, but you don't know what it is that's causing you, why you're not feeling very good. You want to learn. I wanted to learn so bad, and I preferred having. I knew at a young age I wasn't a Hausfrau. I did not want. I wasn't the traditional model. Not that I was against it. I really wanted to do. There was something inside because I loved to learn, and the math was an issue. So I gave up on things because I said, "Well, I'm not intelligent." That became the tape in my head.
Mm-hmm.
So I really didn't. I went to junior college, but I went through a lot of things. I couldn't focus on one thing because I didn't have the confidence to stick with it, thinking I'll do it. So I did have a tendency of giving up with not following through with it. That was my problem. And I really didn't see the word learning disability until the early 80s, and I was in my mid-20s toward my late 20s. And I already had my associate's degree, still trying to figure out what I wanted to do. I knew marriage and having children was not going to cure this problem. It was the whole of my life. I took care of my oldest nephew when he was 3 months because his mother had to go back to work. And that kind of helped me decide, no, I don't think this is a good idea for you right now. I loved him, but I couldn't deal with it 24 hours. So I knew that was not the answer. That wouldn't be good. That's a very serious commitment. I needed to work on myself. The old saying, you know what you want, you don't want to do, but you don't know what you want to do, was kind of my situation. So that is kind of the journey to really overcome the learning disability and dealing with that bohemian lifestyle. It's not a negative. It's not blaming anybody. A lot of people overcome. You're just you who you are. And I found confidence in joining Toastmasters. That was the first thing that I did. And then I loved dance. So I took dancing lessons. And that was the first thing. I got my degree and I wanted to work in fish and game, but due to Proposition 13, they froze the jobs. But I had to work. So I was a ship without a rudder because I needed to dig deep into the really insecure issues that I had on the going back the year, you know, being dealing with feeling that I wasn't intelligent enough, even though I had the passion for learning. I loved to learn. I did well in certain ones. So I really couldn't figure that out, you know, and I'm used to being alone, being that. So instead of reaching out for help, and then I discovered, while I was working in a bank in San Diego, I discovered my love of film, and I started to go back into media. So I was working as a production assistant, and I was working hard on this sports show to be put into Cox Cable so we could all do this full time. And I found that I loved it and that I thrived being a PA and that I was good at doing – I wasn't good at a secretary. I hated it. But I was good at doing diverse jobs. So long story short, it didn't work out. So I found out that I really did – my passion was still communication and media. But San Diego, as fun as it was, did not have the opportunity. So in 86, I came to Los Angeles. And with a short time, I found Warner Brothers. And I needed it to really develop my skills and my confidence. So that 20 and a half years, I don't regret. I don't regret coming to L.A. It's what I needed to do to overcome it. And then at that same time, I saw, again, another show. It was Bill Cosby's real-life son who was murdered in 97, had a learning disability, and he was going to dedicate his life to helping people like myself. And Bill Cosby used to do that in his show with his TV son. And there was an episode that pretty hit home with Theo. And I thought, there it is. That's what affected me. That was, and basically it's mental processes. They said, well, Theo, it's not that you're dumb, it's just the way you process information. And I go, there it is. So that was the aha moment. But you're still kind of dealing with people. So, yeah. So that's why
it took a while to get to that.
Yeah, it did. It did. Because you didn't, see, when they don't know what it is and they don't, if you don't know what it is and you're trying to figure out, you know, in the last 30 years, there's a lot more information and we're much more open with things, I think. You talk about the addiction, like being open with the addiction and alcohol and sex addiction. We're much more, we could talk about it. But in the even in the 70s, people weren't talking about things as open as they are now, so that you can kind of discover and have a support system. It's almost still that you had to be, show that you were perfect almost. You know, that it was still the competition type of thing. And I was very sensitive and very shy, and I thought, how am I going to survive in this world? It's going to get beat up. You know, I mean, there's all of these little neurotic neuroses going around, but there was something said, well, I have to overcome this if I'm going to really have a life. So I did have that deep down, and that's why I went to Toastmasters. So, yeah, my time, somebody once said, I'm a late bloomer. So my journey takes a little bit longer than people.
Better late than never.
That's true.
Yeah. Well, speaking of the 70s, how did the feminist movement affect you?
Well, I had things were starting to pop more with feminists. Again, I always found solace. I loved film and TV. It was kind of my friend in many ways, as being shy and not fitting in. And there were several TV shows that were showing women doing a little bit more than just the traditional in the 60s. And oddly enough, one was with Angie Dickinson called Police Woman, showing the first police woman officer. And then you started to have the rallies, and then Ms. Magazine came in. So they were starting to show that a women's point of view rather than. I remember with All in the Family, even though I was young, they were starting to talk about, it was the first show in a comedy talking about menopause, when Edith was going through menopause and Gloria trying to help her. So women's issues or women's things, and then the pill becoming more, and then Roe versus Wade being passed, that was pretty much in the early 70s, and I was a teenager. So it affects you being that age, and then I already had it in me, even in the 60s, that I was not in the traditional mode. Even though I came from a traditional home, I wanted, so all of this was hitting very fast when I was in high school, from junior high to high school. So it started to go, wow, look at what is opening up for women for the first time. Because in the 60s, you had ads that said women's jobs and men's jobs. Literally had that. In the 70s, it was starting to not do that anymore, to where it just was, if you had a job and you felt you could qualify for it, you go for it, whether it's a management position or not. So a lot of that was really the strong movement of the women's movement was those early 70s, and I was in high school. And things were starting to open. Police officers, women going into science, so really encouraging women to find their identity. Betty Friedan's book was in 64. I was 8 years old. So that book became the Bible. That was the first. And then the book on your body, it's about women's sexuality. Women weren't supposed to have a sexuality. The Kingsley Report came out in the early 50s. And I was born in the 50s. So by the time I came of age, this stuff was really going in a full-blown, like a wave. So it was freer to talk about sexuality, women's sexuality. You could be on the pill. People were, the sexual revolution was still going on, and girls and boys were living together without marriage. It was, you know, you didn't have that straitjacket approach. So it was becoming more freer for women for the right to choose. For me, women's liberation is about just the right to choose my life, not that I have to be this or that, because the standard for women was very severe. In many ways, it still is, but not as bad as it was in the 60s, in the 50s, in my mother's time, or before the feminist movement, which really hit in the early 70s, and that's when I was in high school. Early to mid.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your career. What were some of the most significant moments for you when you were working in the entertainment industry?
Well, I think when I first started out in San Diego, I still was dealing with insecurity and didn't know what I was good at. So when I started the production assistant in San Diego, and as a PA, you're a glorified gopher, but you had to learn to do a lot of things at once. And I found out I was pretty good at it. And I got compliments. So I thought, wow, okay, maybe I am pretty good at this. And then I did a class on photography. Industrial photography, and I did a thing with slides with music. Remember slides?
Going back years. I sure do.
So they put slides together in a carousel, and you'd have music, and they used to do presentations before digital. I'm dating myself. So that was my first kind of creative. I had to create stories with slides with music, and I go, you know, that's not bad. My teacher goes, good, it was a credit, no credit class, but it wasn't bad at all. So I really was, that was the beginning and of my career shifting, wanting to go into the entertainment industry. Not necessarily, I didn't want to be an actor. That's not what my passion was. I liked working behind the development or the organization of content, because when I was working as a PA and a group of us were trying to develop this sports show for Cox Cable, I was a producer. I would go out and look for sporting events for us to talk about. It was a new show that we wanted to do, and we actually were on air on Cox Cable, and we were nominated for a San Diego Emmy. That to me was like, wow, maybe this is working for me. Politics being what it is, there was a clash with a guy who was trying to do this at Cox, and it didn't work out, you know, like all projects. So after doing some freelancing, which I really enjoy, I had a passion. I finally found a passion that I loved, and I actually did a speech on it, and people would come up and say, wow, Paula, that was good. And I said, yeah, I did it off the cuff, too. So between those two, I found what I could do to give me the confidence. And I always loved film. So I said, well, I should have done that, you know, in the beginning. But I realized that San Diego, as fun as it was, as I stated earlier, the opportunity was going to be Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. So that was the high point. And within 2 months of being in L.A., I found a job at Stephen J. Cannell Productions. And Stephen J. did TV shows. He's a writer-producer for Universal. But he did Hunter. I don't know if you remember Hunter and the A-Team.
I do, yeah.
Okay, anybody who's baby boomers who remember 80s television, and I was involved in a year and a half with that. And the writer's strike hit in 1988, and it was a difficult one where it took a long time to resolve. And he was a writer-producer, so that we were laid off. It was a small production company. And I attempted, and then I found Warner Brothers via Lorimar. Remember Lorimar Productions? They did Dallas and all of that?
Yes.
Well, they took the MGM lot. Then Warner Brothers bought Lorimar. So a lot of the aha of my career was that being on my own in L.A. and really finding what my stuff is doing temp work and actually hitching up to a big studio and learning from them. Now, my career hasn't been one of, wow, I worked on huge, big budget. It was the studio as a whole. But for me, it was, I worked in pay TV and cable, which it was starting in its early years, moving into being the dominant television format, and developing a department at Warner Brothers. I was in pay TV and cable. I really enjoyed working with my boss. We're still friends. She got laid off a couple years ago, and we're friends still. I'm hoping we can still work together on other things. But I needed that, David. I needed the stability, and I needed to develop my confidence, my skills, because I became a manager. I was working to be a director in pay TV tech ops, and I really enjoyed it. I originally wanted to be in development, but I got off track. I took an in-depth course. So now I've actually, in many ways, have come full circle, because that's what I want to do now.
Ah, neat. Well, let's talk a little bit about the transition from the corporate world to becoming an entrepreneur. What's that been like for you?
Tough. Emotional roller coaster. Because it's not, number one, what I planned, and it's not, I'm used to being in a team and in an office. The hardest thing was doing this on my own. I don't know, because there's nobody, I don't have a role model in my family. My family has always worked, they've always been good, hard, blue-collar workers. My dad was in the service and then in the civil service. And my mother, before marrying and everything, worked for the telephone company. So pretty much my family background and everybody I knew was all working for someone else. So you're raised in the mindset of World War II parents, of you work for somebody for 20, 30 years, you retire, get your gold watch, your pension, so forth and so on. So as I was getting stable and set at Warner's, that's what I was going to do. The rug pulled out for me. Things started to change. It was really bad. I didn't want to leave Warner Brothers, but I needed to move away from the department or the division because it wasn't working out the way I hoped, the way I planned. But then things happened, whether it was the economy. I don't know if it would have been different if the economy was good, because a lot of the changes are either office politics or the technology changed. It's hard to tell with corporate world. So when, you stated in my bio, when I got laid off, in many ways I was relieved, even though I didn't want to do it because the last year was quite bad for me. I was in a bad situation, and it just wasn't working out with the new boss. I was having some difficulties, and I felt if I want to go out on a high, not on a low, because my quality of work was going down because it just wasn't getting the support. So it wasn't planned to be an entrepreneur. It was trying to figure out what's the next stage. And I was looking at transitioning before I was laid off, but it was a more smoother transition. Warner Brothers until 25 years. It would have been 25 years this June. That's what I was working because I was doing very well with, I have the pension and then the IRA and all of that. And I was looking at that and saying, I'm looking toward getting a bachelor's. I don't have a bachelor's. And figuring out what is that next step. You know, I still hadn't figured it out. I know, as I stated, I wanted to do more in the community. I didn't want to be chained to a desk. That's what I called it. It gave me good stuff, but I wanted to good skills, and I'm grateful, as I stated. But I wanted to get out more, you know, in the public and meet different people and network. And I did realize that I did not network inside. I just kind of stayed in the division. I had that mindset of I will retire out of here, out of this department.
Yeah, right.
So
right.
I did not have the skills. I was behind in a lot of skills. So the transition has been retraining, reinventing, and a world that had changed dramatically. The last time I was laid off was 1988. No internet. No digital world, very, very different on how you do your resume. And I was behind. Even though I was on computers at Warner's, it was more specialized. But I didn't know what all this was, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, all of this. I had no idea. You know, and I was pretty out in the cold, I felt, yeah. So it's been it still is a bit of a roller coaster. And my spiritual practice is what keeps me from wanting to go off the cliff.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. You've moved from Christianity to, I'm struggling with the pronunciation.
Nietzschean,
is it? Nietzschean Buddhism?
Right. It's
yes.
Named
Can you
after
tell us what that is?
It's named after the Japanese monk Nichiren Daishonin in the 12th century Japan. It is a sect. Well, I hate to say a sect, a version of Buddhism. It has many of the elements of Tibetan, but it's meant for modern times. So I know I talked about this before. Basically, Nichiren Daishonin was a monk, Japanese monk, in 12th century Japan. It was going through a lot of things, and he asked the question, being a Buddhist country, why are we going through all of this? You know, that includes a Mongol invasion from the Mongols and natural disasters, horrible. So he found the last sutra of the Shakyamuni Buddha, the first Buddha, the man who founded Buddhism, and it's called the Lotus Sutra, and it's a teaching. And there's a phrase that he developed, which is Nam-myoho-renge-kyo, which means devotion to the mystic law, cause and effect through your voice. So it's a mantra that you chant to build your Buddhism. But also the sutra is about equality. And he felt that what was being practiced in Japan went away from what Shakyamuni Buddha was teaching, which is, you can find Buddhahood through yourself. You don't need to go through somebody. In other words, every religion fractured. So I like the philosophy of Buddhism. It was about compassion and empathy, forgiveness. And I think the history of Buddhism has been less volatile and violent compared to the others. It's had its own problems. But my interpretation of Buddhism at the time was, like everybody else, Tibetans, you know, monks in brown robes with shaved heads, sitting on the mountain contemplating life with their navel. Well, that's not what I want. So this Buddhism is meant for modern, for people who live in a modern context. It's meant to be a vibrant philosophy. And I found it through a friend that I've known for now. She brought me into the practice. She's been practicing since she was 17 years old.
Wow. I have a friend that started around the same time, but I remember the Nam-myoho Renge Kyo. Yes, I remember that chant, but I never knew what it meant, so it's enlightening to hear.
That's a quick definition of it. That's probably about the best way I can say it is devotion to the mystic law through it's cause and effect through your voice, you know. And I like the philosophy and that the people. It took a little while to come to the fold because I had just left Christianity, and it's kind of like I really don't want to go into a religion right now. I had a vacuum, but I had to really deal with the loss that I had since I was a child. I was spiritual, but I didn't know, like my career, my life of a ship without a rudder, it's okay, I'm not too sure now what to do. So it's almost like you have to have a recovery time. You're in a vacuum. So it took a little while for me. It was very, very different. I didn't know what to make of it. And she was very nice. She was not pushy. She just says, Paula, would you like to come with me to a meeting? Or she'd give me some, we have a Living Buddhism, it's a magazine, and then there is the World Tribune, which is the newspaper. The main, headquarters is in Japan, the Buddhism is in 180 countries now. So it is a laity where SGI is Soka Gakkai, which means value creation. So we separated from the priesthood. There was a problem about 23 years ago, and the priesthood excommunicated the laity, the SGI, and that we decided to go on our own because we believe that they were teaching the wrong teachings, that it's not about elitism. It's about each person is equal to another, and you can find your enlightenment through yourself. You don't need a priest to do that. So that's what I liked about it. And it's a tough faith because it's up to you, really, to practice. You will go through a lot. Obstacles are part of the philosophy to really build your faith and build your life condition. You know, a lot of people, it sometimes can be a tough love type of thing. But it's very much on your own. I mean, we have meetings and we have an organization to help you with your practice, but it's really up to you to get in front of the mandala and chant, to study, to really bring your life condition. You are the author of your life, is pretty much the philosophy.
Now, do you chant every day?
Yes, in the morning and at night. My night, my consistency is poor. So in the morning, it's like you polish your mirror before you get up, and then you chant to at the end of the day so that you can relax and keep that mirror polished, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Chanting is a way to overcome the fundamental darkness, and fundamental darkness is negativity in you, saying that you can't do it. You know, it's building that faith of going through whatever obstacle, not being defeated. That's the whole idea, is never, ever be defeated, whatever's coming at you.
It's all about, you're raising your level of vibration to a positive level when you chant them.
Yeah, it's shining your mirror, it's shining your diamond to your life condition, so whatever comes at you, you can overcome it. And you do it with happiness. It's all about being happy. It doesn't mean that, you know, you're thinking kumbaya. It's not that your whole life is going to be great. It's just whatever your condition is, you are not going to be defeated. I'm going to go through this at a higher level. And it's still the Buddhist philosophy of lives, of overcoming your karma. You can overcome your karma. But what's different with this practice is that you can get benefits right now. You can overcome it right now. It's not about 10 lives down the line that you can reach Buddhahood lifetime. So it is about having a practice that has proof to the practice, the benefits.
Now, have you found that you've clung to any of the remnants of Christianity at all?
Yes, yeah. When I was struggling with Christianity, and the struggle goes back to the early, when I was a teenager, you start developing your own personality, you start asking questions on things when you become a teenager. And I was raised in the Episcopal Church. I was baptized. And the Episcopal Church has always been middle of the road. It's never been taking the Bible literally. It is Anglican Catholic, so it's the American version of the Church of England. So the Book of Common Prayer. I was never raised as heavy as a child on the New Testament, but it was never, we always took it in metaphorical, more of Christ's teachings. What is he trying to tell you to be a better life? You know, it's following him in his footsteps as far as compassion and empathy and forgiveness, to really work at that, to be close to Christ. So I stayed with it a long time, and it's a mass. I was involved in the mass. The struggles I had, David, was one was it still has, like all Christian with baptism, that there still was the issue of people who were gay, being homosexuality being a sin. I had a problem with a lot of that. The other is many of the dogmas of the religion, of, like I say, the baptism, if you're not baptized, are you going to go to hell? You know, that type of thing.
Right.
I didn't buy into that. I believe deeds were very important. I think the main things, though, still, even in the Episcopal Church, although things have changed in the 70s, is that it's still a patriarchal religion. And I want to make this clear, I'm not anti-male, or I believe in equality. I still felt as a woman at the back of the bus or back at the church. In other words, a male God, what does a male God got to do with me? I didn't consider myself second class. Everything is still he. I can't say our Father and art in heaven because I don't believe in that. So I started to question the maleness of God. And it wasn't that I was looking for a female God. It's just it was a good platform for me. But as I was growing and seeking on a spiritual level, it still was too much 2,000 years before. And especially the 70s, as we're talking about the feminist movement, although I wasn't in extremist behavior, I still believed women being a human being and have the right to choose her life. I was kind of getting tired of the patriarchal world, wishing there was a world of equality, that we were judged by the content of our character and our personality and not our color of our skin, what God we worshipped, where my plumbing was, or what sexual orientation, as I learned more on that issue. So I struggled for a long time. I'd go to church, not go to church. Then I was given a Bible by my cousin. It was in modern language, and I said, I'm going to sit and just read it for a while. And I read the Old and the New Testament, and actually the Bible helped me to realize that what I love about Christianity is Christ's teachings. What I believe is that he came into this world to teach the human race another way of living, and that he lived, he talked to women. I believed that he had women followers, And after I left the church, I discovered the Gnostic Gospels. And then there was the Gospel of Mary and Gospel of Thomas. So
right.
I believed that Christ was a very enlightened being that in Buddhism philosophy is very right on. And some people believed he went to India and he was teaching Buddhism to the Middle East.
I've heard that. Yeah.
And a lot his teachings are compassion, forgiveness, empathy. It's about serving. It isn't easy to do. But I realized that his teachings got corrupted. And I went to church too much as a habit, as a ritual, and not really digging deep because I wasn't happy. I wasn't happy inside. I wasn't contented inside. I couldn't find peace with it. So I decided I needed to leave the church because it was no longer for me. That's not to say my parents are still very active and I support them in that. So the Buddhism has helped me to deal with the loss of that and not, I went through emotional roller coaster. I got angry too at it that it can be okay. I can help celebrate Mass with my parents without being negative toward it. And the Buddhist practice has helped deal with that.
Well, I think it's so important for people to find a path that is comfortable for them, that resonates with them. And certainly I've heard many people talk about their problems with Christianity as it's been portrayed being a patriarchal religion. And what you said about Jesus and him reaching out to women and that you believe he has women followers like Mary Magdalene, I think that that's a really important thing for people to keep in mind. But as far as having an open mind and realizing that God does not judge, that God is for all people, and that there is no one pathway, I think that's a very important concept for people to get. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't get it. They say it's my way or you go to hell.
Right.
And I believe that's just wrong and is a form of abuse.
Yeah, it is. And I think that's why Christians don't understand why there's anger toward organized religion, because you've had for so long been so suppressive to people who may have had a different interpretation. And now believing cause and effect, that stringent is starting to come back and throwing them in the face because they created such an intolerant God and many a vindictive God and ritual that they don't understand why there's anger toward them. You know, I think all should be respected, but they need to understand people need to seek it. Our founding fathers, I was reading a book on separation of church and state, what they believed religion was a private. It was between your conscience and your God. It's like the Protestant Reformation was having, really the heart of it, was having a personal relationship with God. It really is, once you reach adulthood, you really need your journeys in life as both professional and personal, but your spiritual is just as arduous and just as difficult as your professional or your career. You have to go through those. You know, it's a discovery. It's what is it for me? And I like your church, Unity. I never heard of it until I listened to your show, producing your show, of the idea that people can come into the church and however they interpret God. It can be a he, she, whatever. It's there. So I really liked it. And then I went in and Googled Unity and found out the history of it. So I found that fascinating. And I'm glad it's there to welcome people who believe, have a Christian faith, and are gay. They you know, that they have a right to their Christian faith and be respected to who they are.
Yeah. Well, we've had some competition from my dog tonight. I don't know if you've heard him in the background. But he's been quite vocal. I don't know if it has to do with the Buddhism or when it started. But at any rate, I wanted to give you a couple of minutes to just talk about your show, Second Act Boomers, and share what might be coming up on that.
Well, that's gone through a transition, too. It started out as something I didn't I fell into, just trying to find something. And it's developed into, it's now a radio network on Blog Talk Radio. And what I try to do with the podcast is offer baby boomers like myself in the second act who are in transition, who may have worked in corporate and now don't know what to do or in their transition or having a difficult time with it, to give them the resources and the tools to find the passion to be successful in their career and life, to be happy with it. Because a lot of people I've talked to like me or may have a tough time with the transition. I'm hoping to streamline things so they don't waste the time and money that I have in finding what that passion is. Because sometimes it's been buried so long, maybe they don't know what it is. It's that, what is that? That first step is you've got to figure out what do you love to do. And it's got to be very specific. You've got to dig deep, and it took a long time. So the show, it is a radio network. I have another person, Mary Blake Journals. Her show is on my network. So that's what I'm looking at and coming up as people who are reinventing themselves, who are adapting, experts who can help with certain things to get people started, inspiration of those who have and feel that their life is just starting, whether it's 59 or 60 or whatever that they've got ahead. So inspiration and tools for those in transition in their life that may be having a difficult time or not too sure what that first step is, or if they're in the middle and they still need to move forward with it. Some of the baby boomers I may be struggling with the digital, and you have to bring your skills up, and don't be afraid of it, you know, even though it might drive you crazy. Mm-hmm. So that is expanding to other topics. It first was entrepreneurship, but it's talking on spiritual health and other things of how people because transition, being successful and happy can mean many things to many people. Whatever that transition
I'm sure that speaks to a lot of people too. You know, what is your next show going to be, and when is it going to be?
Actually, I just finished mine. The next one is Friday. Next Friday, it'll have Brenda Pierce from the E Factor, and Brenda
is
a Reiki. She's Reiki technique, and she's a nurse, but she's creating a business of helping people to uplift and enlighten and reaching out to those, because we all know now that we have to really do adapt and reinvent ourselves. So she has kind of her own, but a very spiritual one. So she's going to talk about Reiki a lot and then about her E-factor.
Oh, good. Well, I'll have to listen to that. I like Brenda. I've appeared on her show. Well,
yes,
Paula,
yes.
I'd like to thank you very much tonight.
Well, thank you. I hope I didn't consume it too much for you.
No, not at all. Not at all. You're a very nice, gracious guest, and I've enjoyed what you've had to share tonight. So thank you for bringing your life journey to light and sharing your spiritual experience along the way. And so now we're going to come to a close. Now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing of separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who are having a spiritual experience. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.
Yeah. You have been listening to Different Strokes for Different Folks. To find common ground and take it to the next level, here on Blog Talk Radio with David Clark, every Friday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. You can listen to this broadcast again on srbroadcasting.com.